From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In 1898, Great Britain ruled the world as much as the United States seems to today. That year marked the publication of H.G. Wells' science fiction classic, War of the Worlds, a nightmarish story of invading aliens bent on destroying humanity, on exterminating the human race. That story would be retold in Orson Welles' famous 1938 radio broadcast, a 1953 movie, and again in Steven Spielberg's adaptation that opens in theaters today. The fears that H.G. Wells first raised over a century ago have been resurrected during times of war and insecurity in this country, at times when apocalypse seems entirely possible, coordinated by a more powerful force. Tonight on Point, H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, the way it has been told through the ages and today. But first, we'll listen to some of the most recent retelling of H.G. Wells' science fiction classic, Steven Spielberg's adaptation of War of the Worlds, which is opening in theaters across the country tonight. At the center of the drama is Ray Ferrier, played by Tom Cruise, a divorced New Jersey dock worker who has to fight to keep himself and his two children, his young daughter and teenage son, alive.
That is so weird. The wind is blowing toward the storm.
It's okay.
Lightning doesn't strike twice.
Where's the thunder?
Robbie, you saw the lightning?
Yeah, 26 times on Lincoln Avenue.
Hear that?
Well, joining me now from Los Angeles to give us all a preview is Sean Smith, senior writer for Newsweek. Sean, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You are one of the few people who's actually already seen the movie. So, what did you think?
It's pretty spectacular, actually. It's very impressive in it, and it's what Spielberg does so well, which is to make these huge spectacles that really remain about something very real and palpable to the rest of us, which is usually about family. He does that over and over again with his movies. And so while you've got images in this movie that are like nothing you've ever seen before, that any of us ever have, it's still very much a story about this father and this daughter. And in some ways, it's very much it's as honorable as it is, as faithful as it is to the H.G. Wells book. In a lot of ways, it's actually an improvement on it on an emotional front, because in the H.G. Wells book, it was just a lone man sort of wandering around trying to figure out what was going on. In this, you've got a man trying to save his daughter and son at the same time he's doing that as well, so it gives it a higher emotional component.
Well, from the clip, it certainly sounds very intense. Does it work as a movie, or is it maybe a little too scary for some people?
You know, it is. It's mostly that it doesn't have a lot of boo scares in it, meaning the things that jump out at you or freak people out. It mostly, I think, if you're prone to anxiety attacks, it might make you, because there's sort of a general creeping sense of dread that builds and builds. It does get pretty horrifying, but it's not as if it shocks you. It's more like it's sort of every frame makes you sink a little bit lower in your seat until you realize that by the end of the movie you're sort of curled into a fetal position.
Ooh. Well, you mentioned the personal aspects of the story, and I'm wondering, in trying to make Tom Cruise a not-so-great father at the beginning instead of right away this big action hero, does that make the story and does that make Cruise's role more believable?
In a lot of ways, I think it does. I think it shows what happens. They were sort of very set on, David Kapp, the screenwriter, and Spielberg were very set on sort of making this a blue-collar guy and someone who was not necessarily, most of the time when you do movies like this that are about aliens invading Earth, they're scientists or the president of the United States or someone who's sort of our protagonist. And so they wanted it to be someone who was none of those things. I think it does help only because it also gives his character somewhere to go, meaning if he starts out as this great guy, you can't get much greater as you go through a trial. And if you start out as kind of a jerk, it gives you room as the movie progresses and you endure horrible things to become kind of a good guy in the end.
Speaking of horrible things, what are some of the ways in which Spielberg invokes memories of 9/11 in this film?
There are some pretty chilling things. The scenes of pandemonium, what happens is that, without giving too much away, these aliens the spaceships come up from underneath the Earth. And so all these people are sort of gathered around trying to figure out what's going on, and these ships come up, and they just start without warning or without explanation, just sort of obliterating people. And literally, these people just burst. They sort of ignite and burst into dust. Sort of calcify, basically, is what's happening to people. And it these crowd scenes are really horrifying, and it feels very real because it looks, especially with all the dust and everything, it looks, that first attack looks so much like the footage that the rest of the world saw of 9/11 and people running through the streets of New York. He also does things when the attacks first start happening. Dakota Fanning, you know, doesn't understand. No one understands, and she screams, "It's the terrorists!" You know, and so he does. It's not overhanded or heavy-handed, I mean, but it is. It's obviously very present in the story.
Spielberg has spoken before about how he dreamed as a young boy of becoming the Cecil B. DeMille of science fiction, and so now we've seen from him Close Encounters of the Third Kind and E.T. and AI and now War of the Worlds. Fair to say that he has succeeded in that goal?
I think he's probably surpassed Cecil B. DeMille. As great as Cecil B. DeMille was. I think he's done it. I think he just, and it's interesting to me because when he does, what amazes me about Spielberg is that he continues to amaze us, I guess, in that there are, that you can sit there and you're just, the spectacle of what he creates is so far beyond what other filmmakers can do. A friend of mine said there's directors and then there's Spielberg. And I kind of feel that way, which is not to say he's a flawless director. He can be overly sentimental at times, but not in this movie. And he's nobody's a more proficient no one's more expert in the actual technique of filmmaking. It really is believable.
Sean Smith, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Sean Smith is a senior writer for Newsweek. He spoke with us from Los Angeles. It is opening night of War of the Worlds, and so we're taking a closer look at the retelling of H.G. Wells' classic novel from Orson Welles' radio broadcast to Steven Spielberg's Hollywood blockbuster. Are you a fan of War of the Worlds, or is the world scary enough as it is? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Chicago is Dan Danello, independent filmmaker, film professor at Columbia College there, and author of the forthcoming book, Technophobia, Science Fiction Visions of Post-Human Technology. Dan, welcome.
Hi.
And also with us from Chicago is Alex Lubertosi, co-editor of The War of the Worlds, Mars Invasion of Earth, Inciting Panic and Inspiring Terror from H.G. Wells to Orson Welles and Beyond. Alex, welcome to you.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Good evening, I should say.
Dan, let me start with you. Remind us of what was going on in the world when H.G. Wells wrote the book in the first place back in 1898.
Sure. The original novel was published when England viewed Germany's growing war machine with extreme anxiety, so that was part of it. Wells fused that anxiety, and there was also a popular fascination with Mars at the time. So War of the Worlds conceived of devastating Martian techno-weapons, buildings crushed with monstrous tripods and humans strangled with black vapor. So there was a suggestion of the approach of the mechanized slaughter of World War I with its tanks and airplanes and poisonous gas. But as you said at the beginning, Britain was at the height of its imperial expansion and power and confidence, and its prowess was unassailable, or seemingly so. And Wells had the audacity to imagine the British as defenseless as the people that they were dominating. So from another angle, the book can be viewed as a critique of British imperialism.
And so,
yes.
Actually, I just wanted to ask Alex as well then to sort of fast forward us, if you will, and tell us how it became a radio program then 40 years later.
Well, it's interesting about that is that Orson Welles took this, and he's a 23-year-old kind of boy genius in New York. He's become famous at a very young age on the stage, and has recently, I think in 37, got in charge of a radio show. CBS gave him his own radio show. And he kind of had free reign. He was doing a lot of very highbrow sort of things on the radio, Julius Caesar, and trying some different experimental kinds of techniques. he had grown up in the teens and 1920s, and he was exposed to H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds at first through pulp comics. And that's how a lot of the kids kind of, you know, young kids during the 1920s became exposed to that kind of literature, especially that sort of science fiction and sort of disaster sort of literature was through those pulp comics. He loved the story, and he had the idea, and he was inspired by a few other different things that were going on, particularly things that were going on in the world in terms of news reporting that was just happening at the time, news reports coming from Europe and other live reporting that was just starting to happen. The Hindenburg had just been a year before. And decided to tell the story as a series of news flashes, breaking into. I mean, the story or what you're listening to on the program, if you listen to the 1938 broadcast, it's supposed to be Ramon Raquello and his orchestra, and they're playing dance music. And so they actually have the orchestra. They actually have Bernard Herrmann and his orchestra actually doing the music. And then they break in with these news flashes, and each one of them is sort of like it starts off, you know, very benign. There's a meteor in New Jersey that was discovered, and then they take you to the scene, and it starts to become more and more incredible until finally, you know, Martians are, you know, coming out of this thing and you know destroying, you know, Grover's Mill, New Jersey, with their heat rays, and with the reporter live on the scene being killed at the same time.
Alex, so, hold the thought there, because we're going to listen to one of those clips in just a moment. First, though, we have to take a break. We're talking this hour about H.G. Wells' timeless classic, War of the Worlds, what it has meant to the country in different times of war, and what it means today. What did the 1938 radio broadcast and the original 1953 movie say about the times we lived in then? And what does the new Steven Spielberg version say about the times we live in now? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. Evidently, there's some difficulty with our field transmission. However, we will return to that point at the earliest opportunity.
All of that was from Orson Welles' 1938 radio broadcast of War of the Worlds. What do you hear in that broadcast that spoke to the fears of Americans then? Does it still speak to those fears today? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. And my guests this hour are Dan Dinello, independent filmmaker, film professor at Columbia College in Chicago, and Alex Lubertosi, co-editor of The War of the Worlds, Mars Invasion of Earth, Inciting Panic and Inspiring Terror, from H.G. Wells to Orson Welles and beyond. And also joining me now from Madison, Wisconsin, is Michelle Hilmes, professor of communications at the University of Wisconsin and author of Radio Voices, American Broadcasting, 1922 to 1952. Michelle, welcome to you.
Hi, Gail. Thank you.
Why were people so terrified when they heard this radio broadcast?
Well, I think, as was just said, a lot of it had to do with the impending war and the fact that this war was being broadcast over the radio, a completely new development. People weren't used to it, and live news hadn't been around that long. And I think the other interesting thing is that we just heard in that clip is that when Wells, and actually some credit should go to Howard Koch, who apparently really wrote the script for this, when they did this adaptation, it wasn't just the world that was ending, it was radio broadcasting too. Radio itself as a medium was really put into peril by Wells and his cohorts. And it seemed as though, you know, that technology, amongst all these others, couldn't be depended on.
Well, it also makes you wonder if it was so terrifying because it was playing into people's imaginations. You know, nobody was showing any pictures. It was just the pictures in your head.
And it will be really interesting. I look forward to seeing the movie to see if the images that Spielberg conjures up, which I think will probably be pretty terrific, they couldn't have in any way been matched by the movies in 1938. Radio had better pictures back then, as someone famously said. And that certainly had a big effect on the impact of the show.
And Wells said later that one of the things he was after here with this broadcast was that he wanted people not to accept everything that they heard on the radio. Although it's interesting to note that he waited until some time later before he fessed up to that.
He got in some trouble for that broadcast. NBC got a lot of calls. There was even some talk of suing the network. And then, of course, once it had all boiled down, Wells did quite well out of it. He managed to get a contract to go to Hollywood and make Citizen Kane. So I guess we should all be grateful.
You teach a course that incorporates this radio dramatization. Does it still speak to people as clearly and with the same amount of terror you think that it did in the 30s?
Well, I play it every year in a history of broadcasting class to students who, many of whom have never listened to a radio drama before. And for the first half of the program, they're captivated. They can see those pictures, and they listen to the radio broadcast being broken down. And we've seen those things on the news. You know, we have to interrupt this transmission. I'm sorry, we're having difficulties. Then it gets to the second part where you have the lone survivor, as was, you know, in the novel as well. There's no family situation here. And they get a little bit distance from it at that point, but it's still a wonderful show.
Dan Danello, what should have been the tip-offs to people that, in fact, this was fictional, apart from the fact that, obviously, it's the sort of thing that doesn't happen every day?
Well, for one thing, they announced it at the beginning, but apparently some people missed the announcement. And another tip-off was that the Martians apparently conquered the entire globe in about 40 minutes. So there was a fairly unbelievable speed of which this invasion took place. So maybe that was part of it. But, you know, as Michelle said earlier, this type of radio had just started. I think the Hindenburg Airbus explosion was the first disaster to be broadcast live, and that had happened just the previous year. So people were really just getting accustomed to hearing bad news flashes. So that may have been a part of the gullibility involved.
Well, and also, Alex, you were speaking a moment ago about some of the other things that were going on then. And, you know, the fact that America was just coming out of the Depression, which
right.
must have felt so overwhelming and, you know, forces that people just couldn't understand and couldn't control. Was that a piece of it as well, in addition to the rumbles of war on the horizon?
Yeah, I think it had a lot to do with just sort of general uncertainty. And people had gone through in the last 9 years. And in 1938, they weren't out of the Depression by any means, so they were still... You know, I think, in fact, 37, I think, was one of the worst years. So I think a lot of that uncertainty of just not knowing what's going on, and then you hear something on the radio that is just one more unexpected. I mean, it's like at a certain point they start to expect terrible things, but they just don't know what it's going to be next. And I think that may have led, you know, to some people who were just expecting bad things to happen and just jumped the gun because they could have easily switched to another station and realized, gee, NBC isn't covering this, and mm-hmm. Mutual Network isn't covering this. Maybe I should check the, you know, station listings. A lot of the people who panicked didn't obviously bother to do that.
Well, some of our listeners got to hear this broadcast as well. I want to go to Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and hear from Ken, who's on the line. Hi, Ken.
Yes, good evening. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, my dad told me about this broadcast when I was very, very young. And it happened that night south of Oshkosh there was heat lightning. So it would have been about the area of Milwaukee it would have looked like. And he said people were piling into their cars, getting out of the city, shotguns were getting loaded. They actually, and when I, in the 50s, heard this for the first time, the rebroadcast, I couldn't figure it out because, as I remember, not only was there an announcement at the beginning, but there was also an announcement at one of the station breaks. And one of the other things you folks haven't mentioned is the excellent TV series War of the Worlds, which jumped off from a basis of this invasion actually having been happened and then sublimized by the Martians, so we didn't know about it. That was on TV for about 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Well,
Ken, thanks for the call. Yes, go ahead.
Just one thing I wanted to mention: you were talking about why people didn't hear the announcement at the beginning of the program. What we talked about, one of the things we talked about in the book and discussed, and this was appeared to be a pretty big factor, was the fact that the Orson Welles Mercury Theater on the air was a very low-rated show. It had about 3.6 rating. It was going up against the Edgar Bergen Charlie McCarthy Hour, which had a 36 or 37 rating. It had 10 times the audience, basically. Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, it was a variety show, so Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy would do their act for about 5 or 6 minutes, and then they came on with a musical interlude. At that point, apparently, according to the, I think it was a Crossley rating service, people who actually did this kind of study back then, about 4 million people switched around to see what was on the other stations, like, you know, just like people would do today, they would channel surf. And people tuned in too late to hear the announcement that this was going to be the War of the Worlds, but just in time to hear that there was a meteor that landed in New Jersey, and we're going to go live on the scene to see what it is. So a lot of people tuned in too late to hear it. And that you know, we suppose, and a lot of people suppose, that that was a big part of the reason that so many people did not hear the initial announcement and only listened up until the point where, you know, the militia was called out and all this kind of stuff, and left, a lot of people left their homes before the intermission. So there's a couple of good reasons why a lot of people didn't hear any of the announcements.
Well, it's easy to understand. If you tune in and you hear that New Jersey's been obliterated, you may not be inclined to keep going and hearing what else is on. I want to go to Rockland County, New York now and hear from Jack. Jack, you heard the broadcast?
Yes, I did. I was 11 years old, and I heard it from the beginning. I heard the disclaimer, you know, so I knew it was a radio program. And I told your screener that my mother and father and I, we didn't have a phone, had to go out to make a phone call for something. And people were running to the candy store trying to get in the phone booth. And one woman was hysterical, and she said, they've landed on Raymond Boulevard. And I lived up in North Newark, and you could see down the river, you could see Raymond Boulevard. I said, nothing's happening. I said, this is a radio program. Oh, well, you're only a kid. What do you know? People don't realize that we lived in the 30s. We lived by our radio. And I recall seeing the Hindenburg fly over the Jersey Shore the summer before it burned, and then hearing it on the radio. And Wells did such a job of making it so realistic.
I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, even having heard the disclaimer, was it still scary as you were listening to it as an 11-year-old?
Well, no. I mean, you know, perhaps 11-year-old kids, you know, I heard the disclaimer. I knew it was only a radio program, and I looked down the Passaic River towards Raymond Boulevard, and I saw that nothing was going on, you know. And the radio program had said, oh, Raymond Boulevard's on fire, and they talked about Grover's Mills. Well, of course, I couldn't see that. That's down near Princeton. But, you know, grown-ups said, and you had to live at that time. The Spanish Civil War had been going on for a couple of years. The Italians had invaded Ethiopia. There was fighting in China. And World War II was looming. I mean, you know, this is right after Chamberlain and Peace in Our Time in Munich.
Interesting time indeed, Jack. Thanks so much for the call. Appreciate your sharing your memories of it. Dan Danello, I want to come back to you and ask about this first movie version that came in 1953.
Sure.
So fast-forwarding a little bit from the radio broadcast, what was going on in the world when the first version of the movie came out?
Well, the first version came out in 1953, and of course, following World War II and the Holocaust and the nuclear horror of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the 50s were dominated by new fears. And, you know, the threat of communism was amplified by McCarthyism. There was atomic bomb testing. There were other dangers, radioactive fallout. I was a kid then, so I was going through duck and cover exercises and listening to air raid sirens on a weekly basis. So there was a real, I guess what you'd call a Cold War paranoid atmosphere. And so the movie came out around this time, and it was also part of a science fiction boom. There was an increase in UFO sightings. There was the famous 1947 Roswell UFO sightings, and then following that, a real uptick of UFO sightings. So that combined with dangers of a communist attack and the fear of a nuclear Armageddon and a sort of general suspicion of science and technology, those seem to be the sort of paranoid fears that were reflected in that first movie version.
And actually, we have a clip of that, Dan. Let's play that now.
Bilderbeck has calculated how long we have got until Martians take over the entire world.
If the A-bomb fails, that is.
The Martians can conquer the Earth in 6 days.
The same number of days it took to create it.
Attention, please. 2 minutes to bomb time. Prepare to take shelter. If you have no goggles, turn away. Remember, the heat flash and concussion that follow are dangerous.
Alex Lubertosi, it sounds kind of innocent by comparison, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, every version before, I think we become more sophisticated as the years go on, and advances and those things do. You know, H.G. Wells' version is very innocent in terms of the technology, even though, as Dan pointed out, it sort of predicts some of the mechanized warfare that was to come. It doesn't really even grasp the advantage of air power. I mean, H.G. Wells still has them, you know, walking on these tripod machines. The 53 version has them in flying machines. But it was definitely a more innocent time in the 50s. And I think people, you know, I think that what Dan said about, you know, people sort of being on edge because of what was going on with the Cold War, and then, of course, the rise of science fiction really aided in helping this movie take off.
Michelle, do you think the radio broadcast, though, is the highest barrier here or set the standard for subsequent versions?
Well, you know, the thing that the radio broadcast has that nothing else does is the panic. And in a way, it's the panic over the broadcast that's almost more famous than the property itself. I don't think the television, the movie set off in the 50s that kind of reaction. I was interested to hear about the television show from the caller. I'd like to look into that. But again, I think it was really, you know, the panic and the idea of what the power of the media was that was part of its effect then.
Well, Alex Lubertozzi, you know, we certainly view ourselves as so much savvier in this century than when Wells first wrote the book. But, you know, we are also fascinated and afraid of the unknown. Are we more similar fundamentally to the people of Victorian England than we perhaps might care to admit?
Well, I think some of the similarities that exist, the similarities in terms of the empire of, you know, Great Britain being the dominating power of, you know, in that era, and of also, and being, you know, the fact that today, I mean, at this point in American history, I mean, you know, with the Iraq War having gone on since 2003, with our kind of going on that, you know, taking that on and doing that, which is a little, you know, different, a very different kind of war than we fought in the past, where we've actually gone preemptively to go into another country. And we are exerting our power in a different way, you know, than we have before. I mean, there's certainly some, you know, parallels that you can draw between Great Britain in the latter part of the 19th century and America today.
Well, and Dan, in terms of the 53 version, was that a big hit? I mean, did people come into the theaters drawn there with memories of having heard the radio broadcast and willing to suspend disbelief and be scared again?
It wasn't like a monster hit. It wasn't a blockbuster, but it probably made the top 20 of the year. It was considered popular and profitable, but not extraordinarily so. And as I said, it was part of like, you know, a dozens of science fiction movies that really dominated the 50s. So, you know, to some extent, but I think it was, a new generation, less so the generation that had heard the radio broadcast.
And Michelle, as your students next time listen to the broadcast, do you think they will listen to it with a different sensibility, having presumably seen the Spielberg version?
Well, it's amazing what a current movie will do to perk up people's interest in history. I now actually can get people interested in Morse code on ships after the Titanic came out. So if that worked, then yes, I think that actually they'll be seeing it with new eyes, or hearing it, I should say, with new ears.
Well, and you'll be adding to your curriculum as well, apparently, from
yes.
If I was hearing you properly a moment ago. Michelle Hilmes, I know you have to go. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Michelle is professor of communications at the University of Wisconsin, also author of Radio Voices, American Broadcasting, 1922 to 1952. We have to take a brief break here, and then we're going to continue our discussion about H.G. Wells' classic novel, War of the Worlds. What do you think War of the Worlds says about humanity? How does it speak to our vulnerabilities and our fears, to our will to survive? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to continue after a break. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about H.G. Wells' classic novel, War of the Worlds, and how it speaks to America in different times of war. Before War of the Worlds came to America, it was first a novel set in Victorian England during the golden era of the British Empire. But the vulnerabilities that H.G. Wells first wrote about in 1898 still hold a chilling resonance today.
No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that this world was being watched keenly and closely by intelligences greater than man's, and yet as mortal as his own. That as men busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied, perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. With infinite complacency, men went to and fro over this globe about their little affairs, serene in their assurance of their empire over matter. It is possible that the infusoria under the microscope do the same. No one gave a thought to the older worlds of space as sources of human danger, or thought of them only to dismiss the idea of life upon them as impossible or improbable. It is curious to recall some of the mental habits of those departed days. At most, terrestrial men fancied there might be other men upon Mars, perhaps inferior to themselves, and ready to welcome a missionary enterprise. Yet, across the gulf of space, minds that are to our minds, as ours are to those of the beasts that perish, intellects vast and cool and unsympathetic, regarded this earth with envious eyes, and slowly and surely drew their plans against us.
Again, that was from the introduction to H.G. Wells' original novel, War of the Worlds. And so we ask, are we more paranoid now than when H.G. Wells wrote his book in 1898? Do you still see us living in a time of what he called infinite complacency? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us from Chicago is Dan DiNello, independent filmmaker and film professor at Columbia College there, and Alex Lubertosi, co-editor of The War of the Worlds, Mars Invasion of Earth, Inciting Panic and Inspiring Terror, from H.G. Wells to Orson Welles and Beyond. Dan, I want to go back to this idea of aliens invading. You know, what is it about that notion in particular that we seem to find so compelling? Why are we so paranoid?
Are you talking about contemporary times or in general?
In general. It's a theme that seems to resonate across all of these years.
Well, it's a typical horror movie theme, and it's a typical science fiction theme in the sense that aliens are presented as being monstrous and presented as being the other, so that in these movies and other forms of art, the culture often portrays aliens as sort of the culture's greatest fear, or what the culture hates the most. So that's the way in which, say, the aliens over the years can be interpreted. That is, in the H.G. Wells novel, they can symbolize the impending German war machine. In the Orson Welles version, they can be seen as the Nazis across Europe, the communists in World War II, and in contemporary times, the aliens can be seen as a terrorist force emerging with weapons that we haven't been able to predict or confront. So I think there's that aspect of it, the sort of monstrous force that tries to disrupt normal life and take us over.
To Tewksbury, Massachusetts now, we want to hear from Michael, who's on the line. Hi, Michael. What do you think? Is this just part of our DNA?
That's a funny way to look at it. It may be part of our culture, perhaps. The parallel that I see is the sort of the flip side of the threat that Alex was just talking about, which is that we tend to respond or in a very hyper-reactive way to threats that may not really be real. And the Orson Welles radio show, you know, caused this really absurd panic, and it's sort of amusing to think about that little airplane that strayed into Washington, D.C. airspace and caused all the congressional and White House staffers to be hustled out of the building in a huge panic. And I sort of see that as a little bit of a parallel, maybe the flip side of the coin.
Michael, thanks for the call. Alex Lubertosi, back to you. If you remember, Spielberg envisioned Close Encounters for us, and then he introduced us to E.T., and his aliens were good guys, or at least they seemed to be benign. They weren't out to capture Earth or to, you know, eat us or plow us under. They were here to study it and us. So, you know, is this a film that, or could he have not made those films now? You know, did it require this
time?
That's
an interesting question. Yeah, I think other people have kind of commented on that. Would that movie go across, that kind of movie go across? I mean, I think it is interesting. I mean, I think there's two, it's two sides of the same coin, the unknown, the alien. I mean, since H.G. Wells' story, which I think is one of the first ones to ever really go into detail in terms of positing an alien invasion or alien contact, and, of course, the first stories and the other stories that took off from his story were all stories of invasion, of the unknown alien coming to this planet, being more technologically advanced than we are, and wanting to kill us. And I think in the 70s, well, I think, let's say the 50s, I think the one exception that I tend to think of is The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is, I think, one of the first ones that I can remember where the alien isn't a threat, but is actually trying to tell us, you know, trying to teach us something because they're more advanced than we are. But in the 70s when you had, and later in the 80s when you had Spielberg's E.T. and Close Encounters and movies like Starman and so forth, things like that, where the aliens were, you know, it was sort of the flip side. Is like instead of being afraid of the unknown, it was sort of the hope of the unknown. So there's things out there that we don't know that maybe we should know and that we should be exposed to, and maybe this would be a good thing. And then the conflict in those stories centers around, you know, there's a government that's, you know, afraid of it, of this unknown, and they shouldn't be. And so it's interesting that Steven Spielberg, you know, the person who was really known for E.T. and Close Encounters, is making a remake of War of the Worlds, which is really the model for all of these paranoid invasion, you know, stories.
Dave's on the line now with us from New York City. Hello, Dave, and welcome to you.
Hi. I love science fiction. I'm only 49, but I did hear the original broadcast of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. I've heard it about two or three times. I saw the movie. It was a good movie, but I did not hear the remake of the radio broadcast. But the original movie was in the H.G. Wells radio broadcast. Well, basically, the way I understood it, about just a couple of people trying to survive, and it really wasn't about the whole world coming together to fight an alien invasion. They only fought the war from one point of view. And getting back to the caller who talked about the War of the Worlds TV series, that was good for the first year because, without getting too graphic, it had aliens who were able to blend in with humans, so you couldn't tell who was who until a certain period of time where the humans were used up. And then after that, was the producers were changed after the first year, and then they screwed it up. The whole premise of the whole series screwed up, and it was basically canceled after that.
Well, Dave, thanks for the call. And I want to ask Dan, you know, what is the attraction of Mars, whether it's little green men or some other kind of alien creature? Why do they seem to come from Mars? Why not, you know, Saturn or Jupiter or somewhere else?
Well, for one thing, Mars is relatively close, And at the time of the H.G. Wells novel, they'd first spied these potential canals, and so the possibility of life there, someone digging the canals or water on the canals, so that possibility of life existed. Spielberg actually dropped that specific Martian aspect, and it's sort of just generalized vague aliens from you don't know where. So apparently he's perceived that we're not so fascinated by Mars since we've been there, and to some extent found that there aren't any monsters or nice people there either.
Well, we're about out of time, but I want to ask you both, are you rushing off to see the movie?
I saw it today.
You've seen it? Aha, okay.
I'm planning to see it tomorrow. Yep.
All right, well, it'll be interesting to see what the numbers are from this one, won't it? Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gail.
Dan Dinello is an independent filmmaker and film professor at Columbia College in Chicago, and Alex Lubertosi is co-editor of The War of the Worlds, Mars Invasion of Earth, Inciting Panic and Inspiring Terror from H.G. Wells to Orson Welles and Beyond. You can continue the conversation online. Just go to onpointradio.org. In just a moment, War of the Worlds star Tom Cruise shines the spotlight on Scientology. This is On Point. The recent, somewhat odd behavior of War of the Worlds star Tom Cruise has cast a new spotlight on the Church of Scientology, of which he is a member. In the past few months, Cruise has become much more outspoken about Scientology, which some consider a cult. He set up a Scientology tent on the set of The War of the Worlds during filming. Last week on the Today Show, Cruise ripped into actress Brooke Shields for her use of antidepressants. Scientologists are adamantly opposed to psychiatry, calling it a pseudoscience. Several countries, including France, the UK, and Canada, have all taken official positions against Scientology. Well, joining me now is James Verini, who has written part one of Salon.com's four-part series on Scientology. James, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Help us understand, or at least as best you can, explain some of Tom Cruise's behavior recently and how that might be related to his beliefs in Scientology.
Well, what we asked in the article was whether his behavior was evidence of him reaching a new very high echelon of the church. The church is broken down into a number of levels, the parishioners anyway, and the highest level is called OT, or Operating Satan, Satan being the Scientology term for soul.
Spell that one for us.
I'm sorry?
Spell that word for us.
T-H-E-T-A-N.
Okay.
It's a word that L. Ron Hubbard came up with. He came up with a lot of words, and so the buzz in Scientology circles among former Scientologists and people who study the church is that Tom Cruise has reached this level called OT7, which is the penultimate level. There are eight levels in OT, and past OT3, that's kind of the benchmark level. You're led into a Scientologist is led into a lot of the secret, very, very, very secret cosmology of the church, and also led into the notion that everyone, all humans, are sort of inundated with the dead matter, if you will, of an annihilated alien civilization, or such as what I understand from people who study the church and former members and a current member.
But it's very hard getting people to talk about this.
It's extremely hard to get them to talk about it. The church is extremely secretive, and they guard their secrets well. Former members are strongly encouraged not to speak. Current members as well. But lately, it's been coming out a lot. The internet has not been a friend to Scientology. A lot of former members have found gathering places on the net, chat rooms and websites. And so all of this stuff about the cosmology, about an evil warlord who 75 million years ago performed a kind of holocaust on the peoples of many planets and brought them to Earth, this is all kind of well known now on the internet, so they're having a much harder time keeping the secret.
Why do so many celebrities seem to become involved with Scientology?
That's a really great question. People will probably want to speculate about the, you know, general IQ of the acting profession, but L. Ron Hubbard apparently had made very explicit directives in the 1960s or 70s about recruiting celebrities. He called celebrities and artists and other public figures opinion leaders, was his term for them, meaning that, you know, they had the sort of public clout and charisma to sway people. And he published in the church, and some of these things have made their way out, volumes upon volumes of technical bulletins, he called them, which were basically internal memos, in which he instructed his minions and disciples and the C organization of the church, which is its high management level, to do all sorts of things, including, apparently, according to the people who I've spoken to, professors and so forth, to recruit celebrities, although I've never seen those documents myself.
Well, is all the attention that Tom Cruise is bringing to Scientology helping its cause, or are the numbers up?
That's a really good question. They don't release recruiting numbers. They claim that they have 8 to 10 million members and that it's growing all the time. Critics claim far less, in the hundreds of thousands. They claim over 5,000 churches worldwide. I think there's no question that in Los Angeles, particularly where I have to guess the largest recruitment occurs, the celebrity must be the celebrity factor in the church must be a draw for a lot of young people who join. I mean, there's also the draw of it has a very kind of self-help aspect to it. It kind of, you know, it offers cures for your, you know, your inhibitions and personal flaws. If you join us, we can teach you how to overcome them. So that plus all of the celebrity members, I think, can be a pretty powerful draw for some people.
James Verini, thanks so much for telling us about it.
You bet.
James Verini has written about Scientology for Salon.com. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. This is On Point.